Welcome to the LeanZone.com podcast, where we discuss construction contracts, liens, and bonds. And now, our host, Alex Barthet.
My name is Alex Barthet. I am a construction lawyer. I'm fortunate to represent all of you. And the best use of a lawyer is to keep you out of trouble, not to get you out of trouble once you're in trouble. So today we're going to talk about the 7 tips that I can give you during the course of a construction project so that from beginning to end you can identify where problems may exist before they happen and how to deal with them. And at the end, hopefully, you have a happy client at the same time. So a good job, I think everyone would agree, is defined as one that starts on time, finishes on time, maybe even early. You manage the expectations of your client as well as your subs and vendors. You get paid, and you leave the experience along with your clients, your subs and vendors happy, ready to do the next job. So how do you start a project so that you can achieve all of these goals? Number one is you need to understand your contract. You need to understand what your contract says and what it doesn't say. And we'll talk later about what's in the contract and what you should put in the contract. Just as important as the contract you have with your client are the contracts you have with your subs and vendors. Because liability can creep up upon you under by a vendor that thinks that they're owed money when in fact they're not. And there are ways you can deal with that problem, and we're going to talk about those ways. So let's talk about the contract. Ideally, it should be in writing. You'd be surprised how many times we see clients that come to us and they have no agreement in writing, yet they expect to enforce something. So number one, almost always it's better to have any agreement in writing than no writing at all. In that contract, you should identify when you're going to start, what the start date is, when the completion date is. But one of the things you have to remember is the perspective with which you look at the construction project. You need to be aware that when you deal with your client, you want to create some latitude in the way that you get to work. But when you deal with your subs and vendors, that you minimize the ability for them to have that same wiggle room. So let me give you a specific example. When you have a time frame in your contract with an owner, you want to start that time frame from the issuance of some item, ideally the permit. And you want to count from the issuance of the permit forward as the time that you're going to finish the job, versus putting in a fixed date that is measured on the calendar. Now, the converse is true. When you get a vendor that you're going to hire, you want to try to hold their feet to the fire. So you want to say that they need to finish by June 5th rather than giving them days against the issuance of a permit. Understand that that nuance may be subtle, but in certain instances it becomes very important when you have to negotiate with your vendor. And those issues permeate through the contract. And when we talk about releases, we're going to talk about why the release you get from your vendors is going to look very different than the release you're going to give to your client. So when you deal with your subcontractors, they may give you a proposal. And you may look at the scope of work, and you may negotiate that scope of work. And then there may be terms and conditions, and you ignore those terms and conditions. That is a big mistake. The landmines are in the terms and conditions. Fine print. It's always in the fine print, right? Damn lawyers. So so when you, one of the things that we have given to Karina is a form subcontract.
Para los subcontractos.
Right. So one of the things you should do is you should be using that form subcontract and taking the negotiated scope of work that you have with your vendor or sub, take that, transpose it, and put it in the scope of work of your terms and conditions on your subcontract, and that's what the vendor and subcontractor should be signing. The difference, of course, is that their terms and conditions say if they're late, it's no problem. They can stop working if they haven't been paid. If the parts are unavailable, they don't have to perform. Lots of horrible things that you can't live with because there are promises that you have made to your client that are in that subcontract that run counter to the promises you made to your client. So again, when you're dealing with subcontractors and vendors, make sure you read and understand their terms and conditions, their scope of work, and their exclusions and assumptions. Those are also important, right? So lots of people like to put in exclusions in the contract. You need to understand what they are. So let's talk about tip number two. Timely send your notice to owner or other notices that you need in order to protect your lien rights. Now, most of the time, you all are in direct contract with the owner of the property. So under the lien law, you do not need to send a notice to owner. I would still suggest that you do because it lets the owner know that you're serious about getting paid. You may have to explain what the document is, but you should still send a notice to owner. Again, if you have a direct contract with the owner, you don't have to. The rule is that that has to be done no later than 45 days from your first work on the project, but any time after you sign a written agreement with the owner. So you may not start for 2 months. They sign the contract today. You can send the notice to owner tomorrow. There are services that you can use. I can give you the name of some services. Sunray Construction Solutions is the one that we would recommend. Yeah, they're very good.
Our time frame to do it is at the beginning of the when we sign the contract, or we can do any time in the process.
You can do it at any time, no later than 45 days after you start the work. So from the time you sign the contract all the way through 45 days, you can send it. Now, 45 days is the absolute last day to send it. Is the absolute last day for the owner to receive it. So you shouldn't be waiting until the 44th day because they may get it on the 48th day and then it's too late.
Okay.
So your internal procedure...
After 45 days, we cannot do it.
Correct.
Okay.
So ideally, your internal procedure should be you sign the contract and you send the notice to owner.
Okay.
That should be your internal process. You sign the contract, and then within days of that, if you use Sunray, you go onto their system, and then they'll issue the notice to owners. So they do everything. They generate the form. They sign it for you. They mail it out. Everything is done. It's all online for you to check later. At the same time, you're going to be preparing the notice of commencement. You're going to be recording the notice of commencement. You're going to be pulling the permit.
He need notice of commitment.
Correct. Anytime you do permitted work, right.
But a notice to owner is not here. And
right. So that you should send it. So the converse of that is that once you start the job, you're going to be getting notice to owners from your subcontractors and vendors. So for each project, you need to monitor the notice to owners that you receive on that job. Keep in mind that you may be out in the field, the notice to owner from, pick somebody, Banner Supply, whoever you buy your drywall from, right? That supplier is going to send a notice to owner here. You need to have an internal process so that notice to owner gets tracked to this job. So that, and the reason it's important is that everybody that gave a notice to owner, you need to get a release from them every time you pay your subcontractor and supplier. So let me be very specific.
The partial lien releases.
Correct. And I have samples here, which is the same ones I gave you, and we're going to talk about why they say what they say. So So we're going to talk about how to exchange releases for checks later in a few minutes. Okay, so now you've started the job. So let's talk about what happens as the job is running. So tip number three, project documentation. Absolutely, positively critical that you document things that happen on the job. And that documentation, it doesn't have to be special. It can be an email. Text messages are a little transitory, meaning text messages seem to disappear. Emails stick around forever.
Weekly report.
You should be, ideally, you should be doing dailies to the extent the job calls for daily reports, but at least weekly reports. Anything, the rule you need to remember is that when we show up in court, right, because that's why the documentation is important. It's not important when the job goes well, because no one's ever going to look at it again. It's when something doesn't go well. If it didn't exist in a piece of paper at about the time the incident occurred, it's like it never happened. That's what you have to remember. So that conversation you had a month ago, where the subcontractor said this and you said that, if it's not in an email, it doesn't exist. Right. Yeah. And that's the mentality that you need to take into how you document the project. So if you have weekly meetings for your jobs or monthly meetings, someone should be taking notes and keeping track of those. Ideally, the best documentation is documentation that you send to somebody else. But there's nothing wrong with keeping a journal or a diary. That is still valid documentation to the extent that we can show that that's how you did what you did. So even if you generated dailies or weekly notes and they just existed internally, that's still a valid record. A better record would be a meeting, a monthly meeting with minutes that is sent to everyone on the job, because then everyone has an opportunity to see it. And the presumption is if someone receives a piece of correspondence or an email and they don't object to it, they are assumed to have agreed to it. That rule applies to you too. So if someone sends you something and then you pick up the phone and you say, "What are you talking about? I never agreed to that." Well, guess what? If you don't document that objection in writing, the only thing that will exist in paper form is their statement to you and no response from you back to them. So always remember that I'm not saying you don't pick up the phone, but you still have to document what happened. So if something happened in the field, send an email to your client, to your subcontractor, to the vendor. This summarizes, it was great seeing you at the job site. I look forward to receiving the 7 replacement fixtures that you agreed to send me by June 5th at no cost. I look forward to working with you to finish this job successfully. It doesn't have to be an aggressive note, but now you have a piece of paper that summarizes what just happened so that when the lights don't show up, you can say, "Look, we agreed to this. I sent you this note." So let's talk about materials.
Okay.
Right. So, and it doesn't just apply to materials. It applies to just about everything. Mm-hmm. But materials are a good one, especially natural materials. They look at the samples, and then what shows up is not exactly what they, right? Or they looked at samples 6 months ago, and their recollection of what it was versus what shows up is not the same. At the end, it's the same thing, which is you have an unhappy client. Mm-hmm. So how do you solve that? It depends on where you buy your stone. A lot of them have disclaimers that they have. I can give you one if you want it about material selection.
Yeah.
That the materials that you select now are going to be
different. This is natural.
Correct. If you can find, understand that you know, the issue that we have is the fact that we were involved, even from a distance, in the material selection. You have an example where someone else just picked the materials and now they have the problem. That's the best position to be in, is to say, you know, I had nothing to do with it. That was your selection. One of the things you can do to minimize that is you have at least two providers that you always recommend. Here's provider one and provider two. They're both great. You decide. So now it's, well, you had a problem with provider one. You could have picked provider two. We didn't tell you to go to one or the other, which means then that you're cutting all of your referrals in half, because now they could potentially go to both. But that's one way to further insulate yourself from sending everybody to one place, is to develop a relationship with two places or three places. And you have a list of them, and the client gets to pick. They could go to anyone they want.
But most of them, you know, as I say, even when they come here, you know, they pick the material. I want
right.
this one, I want that one. I don't say, you have to put this one in your apartment.
Right. So what? Right. So the best procedure for that is when they come here and they pick this item, you have lots of samples. You take the sample that they have. They sign the back. They sign a little disclaimer about the material. You take that sample and the piece of paper. It goes in their file, and now if anything happens, you can say, "This is what you picked. What do you want me to do?" And you knew that there was going to be variations in color and hue and texture and, mm-hmm. right?
Could they say with the installation process?
Sure.
No.
You understand you never get rid of all the problems. The goal is that what we want to do is we want to try to pick off the really big areas of problems and minimize it. And understand, when you have a document signed by them that covers most of the arguments they can make, then they realize, well, there's nothing I can do, so I guess I have to deal with it. I, the customer, have to deal with it. When there's nothing signed and you have a crafty individual on the other side, they realize, I can say anything I want. So that's why the goal is with these documents and these procedures is to try to box them in so that we limit what they can do. All right, so let's keep going. We talked about project documentation. Tip number four, which is related to the last thing you said, which is change orders. How do you deal with change orders? I can tell you the best practices to deal with change orders, but I am not the one in the field with the owner where you have to deal with the problem and you have to get the job done. But let me tell you what best practices are when you deal with change orders. Number one, don't do any change order work until you have approval to do it. Now, I know that is a panacea. It's wishful thinking that is always going to happen. But what I would suggest to you is that if your mentality and your process is always to start the work before getting the paperwork, you will never get to a place where you can get the paperwork signed first.
This episode is brought to you by the Miami Construction Forum. This invitation-only group of construction professionals of all sizes and trades meets monthly for an informal lunch-and-learn session on current topics of interest, from getting paid and safety to bonding and insurance. To see the upcoming topics and request your invitation, visit MiamiConstructionForum.com.
I have young children, and they know that I'm the boss. In my house, my wife is the boss. But as far as my kids are concerned, I'm the tough one, and my wife will do whatever they say.
Here is the same. He's the tough one, and with my kids, I do whatever they say.
So what happens? Who do they go to ask questions? They go right to mom, right? And the same is true if you create from the outset with the client. And your vendors, by the way, an attitude that kind of anything goes, they will continue that through the project. If you can try to rein that in early on, you'll realize that those problems become much less significant as the project continues. So when that first change order request happens, you say, no problem. We can do that. We can still maintain the schedule. Let me get you a change order to document that. So, and you turn it around right on the spot. If the change order is take this fixture and I want it over there, right? You need now the painter, the drywall, plumber, electrical. Maybe there's exactly right. You got lots of people that need to give you a number.
Yeah, and when we asking for the approval for the client, is it enough an email or we need something signed?
So it's a spectrum, right? The best would be a formal change order that references the original contract, identifies the scope of work, identifies what the change in price is. Did it go up and go or go down? And does it change the completion date? You know, a change order always has three parts: scope, price, time. So, and by the way, don't ever forget about time. Time is the change order process is the single best way to get time on your contract, because you now have presented a document. Maybe you're late because of something unrelated to the change order, but now you have a document that you're going to get the owner to sign, and you can say, this change, I need another 4 days. They're more likely to sign it in a change order than you wait till the end of the job and you say, we're 2 weeks late. That's not the place you want to be. You want to be in a place where as changes are happening, you're documenting those changes, including time. And understand, if you sign a change order that has no time, the assumption is that there was no time attributable to that change. So, you want scope, price, and time. And I would suggest to you, always, always, always put some time in. It doesn't hurt. Put
time.
Oh, and you have to get a sign. So put another 2 days in. Yes, we can do it, but it's gonna add 2 days to the contract, right? Those days are days you can just bank with a change order. Why not? And especially if it actually does impact the right? So to move this here to there, we need to reroute the fire sprinklers. You know, there's lots of things that can impact the
biggest, you know, is the plans also. Because we have to redo the plans, we have to apply again to the city.
Yes.
It's a process. It's yes. Not just to move the lights. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. So all of that needs to be documented in the change order. So best practice, don't do change order work without a change order in place. Now, sometimes you can't always do that. At a minimum, before, again, important, before you start the work, you have some confirmation between you and whoever the change order is with, by the way. And by the way, there may be a change order between you and a vendor or a sub that doesn't involve the owner. So maybe there was a change and you realize, oh, we forgot to include some component of the work. We now need the electrician to do three other things. You want the documentation to support your position in the change, whether it's with you and a vendor or you and the client, before you start the work, at a minimum. And then you want to follow it up as quickly as possible with a written change order that gets signed by everybody. Tip number five, releases. Releases are your friend. And if you understand how releases work, you can use them to your advantage during the course of construction. So understand there are always two releases. There's the release that you are giving to somebody, and there's the release you're getting from somebody. And those two releases look very different, and they serve two very different purposes. So let's talk about the release that you're giving to somebody. So it's time for you to get a check. You may need to give a release. There may be some clients of yours, they have no idea that they need a release. Don't give them a release, right? Don't give them something that you don't have to give them. Now, if you need to give them a release, the release you should give them is a release that is as narrow as possible. And typically that release is the release that's found in the lien statute. I have a copy here, so you can at least see what it looks like. So this is a release for a progress payment that you would give to an owner, to your client. So it says, the undersigned in consideration of a certain amount of money. Now, when you are giving a release in order to get a check, you should put the amount of the check. Okay? Understand. You're giving the release. You're getting the money. Your release should say what you're expecting. So if you're expecting $87,000, you're going to write that $87,000. You're not going to write $10 because you're getting the check and you're giving the release.
Okay.
This release is a release that you can give to your client because it says that you are expecting a certain amount of money and what you're giving up are only lien rights. Think of the rights that you have as a bundle, right? You have lots of rights. You have rights for delays, for extra work, for other damages, for other change orders, for liens. That's a bundle of rights. What we're saying with this release is we're going to take one of those rights, the lien rights, and I'm releasing those. I still have all these other rights. I'm just giving up this one right. Most owners would be happy to get this document because they believe, unless they're lawyers, mm-hmm. They believe that this is enough to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's...
With the check number amount of the
yes.
check, yeah.
Right. And this release says this release is contingent upon payment of said amount in cleared funds. So if you never get the money, the release is no good. So this is what's called a conditional release.
Okay.
It's very limited, okay? So this is the progress payment. Here's the one for final payment. It is effectively the same, okay? So that's the release you give in order to get a check. If someone, if one of your clients says, oh, I need a release from you in order to give you a check, this ideally is the form of the document you should use.
Okay.
Okay? Yes, this is the one to your client. Now, you now need to get releases every month from everybody that's on your job. Every vendor and every sub, every month needs to give you a release. Before you hand a check to them, you need to get their release. Absolutely, unequivocally, this needs to be standard operating procedure. So this is the one, this is the progress payment release. This is for your subs and your vendors. And this is for progress payment. The first thing you notice, it's a bit longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number two, it says $10. It has a through date. We're going to talk about that. And it says, you see where it says in bold, contractor, you're going to change that to your name. Okay. Where it says property in both of them, you're going to put the owner and their address. Okay. So, now, it comes time to pay everybody on the job. All right, so you've got the electrician, the drywaller, the plumber, and you have all of their vendors. Okay, you should be expecting a release like this, ideally like this. You may get some pushback, and we can talk about that. But you should be getting releases like this from each of those people. Okay, and what it does is, it says, I'm giving you some amount of money. The reason it says $10 is because we don't want to be limited. We don't want to give them an $8,000 check and then they say, no, it should be $12. That's why we say $10. We say, it doesn't matter what I gave you. I gave you something and you gave me a release of everything that you owned, all of those rights we talked about, through the through date. The through date is going to be the period of time that that check represents for the work that they've done. Make sense? So if, what are we? We're in April, right? So maybe you're giving your vendors checks from March, right? So the through date is going to be the last day of March. You're going to give them a check for all of the work they did through the end of March. So the through date and the amount of the check, those two things need to coincide. Understand, of course, that what controls is the through date. So if they're supposed to get 12, you only gave them 8, but the through date is the end of March, they can't come back later and say, oh, you're supposed to give me another $4,000. You can say, no, I didn't. You took that check and you gave me a release through the end of March. I don't owe you anything else. Okay? If you read this document, you'll understand that what it's also releasing, in addition to lien rights, are any claims for delays, fees, costs, losses, expenses, changes, change order work. It also says that they represent and warrant that they've paid all their bills through that date, that they have completed all of the work in accordance with the contract documents. The only thing that this does not release is any retainage. So if in your contracts you're holding back retainage, and I would strongly encourage you to do that. So
what
that
means retainage?
So retainage is an amount that you hold every month.
From the contractor.
Usually 10% from each of your vendors.
Yeah.
So the electrician, he sends you a bill for $10,000. You're going to pay him $9,000, and you're going to hold that one, that 10% until the end. When he submits his final payment application, he's going to say, here's how much I'm owed for the work I just did, plus you've held 10%, and now I want that back. The reason you want that to have that retainage is so that you have a little bit of a nest egg to deal with the problems that happen on the job, so that you have some ability. Because understand, money is power on a construction project. If you have the money on your side of the table and you need to resolve a problem, you now have the leverage to say to them, no, 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 we don't agree to that. We'll give you $5,000, not $10,000. Well, you have the money, so it makes that negotiation easier. So you remember at the beginning I talked about the idea that everybody that's doing work on your job that may have lien rights is probably sending you a notice to owner. That's why you have to keep track of who they are. So the electrician, he goes to World Electric. And World Electric sends you a notice to owner because they're providing the materials on your job. You need to know that World Electric is providing materials on your project so that when you write a check, and you're going to pay the electrician, and you're going to get the electrician to sign this, you need a release from World Electric through the same date. And if World Electric never sent you a notice to owner, then you don't have to worry about it. That's why you have to track the notice to owners per project, so you know that every time you issue a payment to someone that has a notice to owner under them, that you get a release from them too. So let's talk about the difference between the progress payment and the final payment of the subcontractor release. You'll notice that the main difference is that it has no through date. So the final payment waiver from your sub has no through date. And the reason it has no through date is because it's effective as of the day they sign it. Okay? That's number one. Number two, the last sentence is taken out because there's no more retainage, there's no more holdback. So that sentence is removed between the final payment and the progress payment release. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you asked a question. Someone filed a lien on your project, a supplier.
They never asked for a payment. And the next time we walk in the property, there's a letter from them. So who can have that right, our subs, our suppliers, our vendor, whatever it is, to put a lien on the property that we worked on?
Okay, so
and how do we track the
right
notice to owner? How do we find that out?
So step one is every time you get a notice to owner, I'm not sure how internally you
do we get it, or does
the office gets it. That's the thing.
Can a sub send it to the property?
Sure. So a subcontractor or a vendor to a sub, when they send a notice to owner, they're going to send a copy to you as the contractor. And to the owner. Now, a subcontractor does not need to send it to you because they have a contract with you. The subcontractor's vendor needs to send it to you and to the owner, but the sub does not need to send it to you. So the owner is going to get copies of them, and then you need to know that everybody that you have a contract with, you should be getting a release from. Okay, so who do you need to get a release from? Everybody that you're issuing a direct check to should be giving you a release, everyone you have a contract with. Anybody underneath them, which is typically suppliers, that sends you a notice to owner, you need to be getting releases from them too. So your example is, I didn't hear anything, and then I get a lien. What do I do? Step one, figure out, did they send you a notice to owner? Maybe you don't have it in your file. Step two, you call and you talk to any of the suppliers. They'll have a credit person or department, and you tell them, I received this lien. Can you please send me a copy of the notice to owner and proof of delivery of the notice to owner, along with all of the receipts that make up...
Right. Proves that we owe you money.
So those are the three things that they should send you. When they send that to you, you can now see, did they timely send their notice to owner within 45 days to both you and the owner? Keep in mind, 45 days is the day that you're supposed to receive it. Right. But no later than 45 days from the time they started work on the job. That's the latest period of time that they have to send. Maybe you purchased it and 3 weeks later they deliver it. Mm-hmm. So the time for that 45 days to run is from the 3 weeks. So it's they order it 3 weeks and then plus 45 days. That's when they have to get that notice to owner
so
to
if
you.
You got it afterwards, it's like
it's no good. Happened. So understand, filing a lien is a very easy thing to do. It's a piece of paperwork, they notarize it, they sign it, they bring it to the clerk's office, they mail it out. It's a lot of leverage. I guarantee you, there are many liens that may come across your desk that are wrong. They're just wrong. But they do it because it's easy. So it's up to you to do the... To confirm, was it timely? And if it's not, you can go back to them and you can say, no, you're late. Take off the lien. So let's talk about tip number six, which is now the beginning of closeout, right? So how do you deal with the punch list, tip number six? Someone alluded to it already, getting people to sign off on the closeout of the job. There are two parts to the sign-off, right? I am sure all of you have horror stories of a punch list that never, ever goes away, right? So let's talk about how to deal with punch lists. Step one is having a punch list procedure in your contract so that you can point to it, which is in the agreement that I gave you. It talks about the fact that your entitlement to payment is not contingent on the punch list. And there are certain things that people give you as punch lists, which are warranty work. And you'll do it as a warranty, but they shouldn't hold your payment because of it. So step one in the punch list is getting the owner to approve that this is the punch list. That's step one. Because if they don't agree that it's the punch list and that it's the final punch list, the punch list never dies, right? So when you generate the punch list, you should have a form, and ideally you do it as a walkthrough. The punch list is generated, and the owner says, this is my final punch list. So it can be as simple as just a sentence that where you and the owner sign that you've identified items that will be repaired, and it is the final punch list. You have the owner sign it. Right, so you get them to, you generate a comprehensive list of what needs to be done and what is fine, and then they sign it. You then are dispatched to do it, you get it done, and then the list that you present to them should just be effectively those items that were the punch list. And they should then sign off that those items were completed. With the understanding, and again, part of it is just managing the client, that if there's something new, then that's not the punch list, because it didn't show up on the punch list to begin with. That's a warranty item that you'll take care of, but that has nothing to do with payment. Because that really is the issue, right? You're always going to have to go back to do some other things. You just don't want the payment to be held up as a result. Substantial completion and issuance of the certificate of occupancy is the thing that you have to do to get final payment, not complete the punch list. You'll complete the punch list, but that has nothing to do with getting paid. Okay, so that's the punch list. Last tip, number seven, getting paid. How do you get paid? What do you have to do in order to secure your right to be paid? So number one is define what constitutes your right to final payment. We just talked about that. Ideally, your right to final payment is something that's achievable, that's clear and unambiguous. And the best thing is the issuance of a certificate of occupancy. Mm-hmm. Because no one can argue that you either did or didn't get it. If you got it, now you should be entitled to payment. Let's talk about the procedure to assert your lien rights so that you understand what you have to do and the time period in order to do it. So we talked about filing or serving a notice to owner within no later than 45 days from your first work.
Okay?
So that's the notice to owner. The next thing that you have to do is, by the way, I want to be very clear. It's not whether you're owed money or not owed money. The rule is 45 days, no later than 45 days from your first work. Mm-hmm. But again, remember, if you have a direct contract with the owner, you don't need to, but I still think you should. The next thing you have to do is within 90 days of your last work on the job, you need to record a claim of lien. 90 days is the outside limit. 90 days is not 3 months, right? Some months have more than 30 days, some months have fewer than 30 days, right?
Okay.
You have to record the lien no later than 90 days from your last work on the job. And last work is defined as something that would entitle you to be paid. Meaning, punch list work and warranty work do not extend the 90 days. So if you got your certificate of completion, you should know that about that time that your 90 days has started to run on your final payment. So if you show up a month later and do your punch list, the 90 days, you're already 30 days into your 90 days because of the punch list. Remember that. Mm-hmm. Also, if your final certificate of completion requires an inspection, so let's say today you do all of the work in order to get the certificate of completion, but the inspector actually is set up to show up next week, right? So a week from today, the inspector is going to show up. And what's going to happen at that inspection? The inspector is going to meet you there. They're going to look around, and they're going to say, done. Your last work under the lien law is not the day the inspector shows up. It's the day you did the work to be ready for your...
So it's the final building then?
It is the final work that would entitle you to be paid. It's not an inspection, it's not the punch list, it's not the warranty. So you have 90 days from that time to record it.
Mm-hmm.
The lien is good unless it's shortened by the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for 1 year.
Only?
Only 1 year.
And it's renewed?
You cannot renew it. The only thing you can do is file a lawsuit to foreclose on the lien. So if you record a lien, you have 1 year from that date to file a lawsuit to get paid. If you wait a year and a day, you've lost your lien right. There is no such thing as re-recording the lien. You can't go back to the clerk on day 360 and say, here's another lien, I'm gonna just keep it alive. That doesn't work. But understand that the leverage you have over owners many times is the fact that you have the lien. If you wait and you don't put the lien on, you can never go back in time.
They'll take you serious.
Correct. It caused them to take you seriously. So what we did is, we have a website called The Lien Zone where we write articles and publish videos and forms. So we have this, you can pass these out. So this is what we call the CalculLien. It's a little lien calculator that will help you calculate when the notice to owner is due and when your claim of lien is due. If you remember these seven things, these seven tips, you will do a better job of making sure that the job runs well, that you manage the expectations of your clients and your vendors, and you can finish the job without having to call a lawyer. That's the ideal situation. And you can move on to the next one.
Next week, we're going to discuss the difference between employees and independent contractors. Until next time, I'm Alex Barthet.
Thanks for listening to the LeanZone.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or in your favorite podcast app.
For articles, videos, and forums on this and other construction topics, head over to theleanzone.com.